Okay, so Albi Hochhauser is sponsoring the shiur this morning in memory of his mother, Perel Bat Shlomo Zev. So maybe Ilui Nishmata. So the problem with this week's parsha is the impossible things that take place. When I say impossible, of course, I don't really mean impossible. I mean the things which are so difficult to understand, and namely the Jews who stood by Har Sinai, who stood by Mount Sinai, who now find themselves worshiping a golden calf. And as I said, that's something which we need to somehow try to understand. Okay, so let's start reading the verses, and then we'll see what sense we can make of them. So source number one, Vayar ha'am ki boshesh Moshe laredet min ahar. So I apologize for only reading half of the verse right now. And the people saw that Moshe had delayed in coming down from the mountain. Vikahela am al aharon, and the people gathered on Aaron. And I'm unsure about the word al over here. If the word al is the usual, it's what we would have expected. El may have been better, but al sounds violent. It sounds like they descended upon him. So it sounds much more like a crowd, much more like a frightening type of energy which may have been upon them. And it sounds violent. So this is chapter 32, Perek Lamed Bet, Shmot Lamed Bet. Vayomru, and they say, Vayomru Elav, they say to him, Kum, now by the way, that's also not exactly respectful. So that's why I'm saying this power of the crowd is very clear. Vayomru Elav, Kum, Aseh Lanu Elohim, come make for us and over here I do have to admit there is some kind of debate whether how to translate the word Elohim, and let's be perfectly honest about this. There are various approaches among the rabbis, which probably go back to Chazal, but certainly you find it often in the medieval commentaries, and that is what I would call either a cover-up, or they just see things as written as being completely implausible, or from implausible to impossible. So therefore, there's a couple of approaches to take. One is to say they really did what it says that they did, which we haven't read yet, but then it wasn't them, it was somebody else. So there were some impersonators there, and that is the people who we call the Erev Rav. The Erev Rav are the people who were opportunists that when it came time to leaving Egypt, they decided to go and to follow and to leave as well. Now, but let's recognize something. The Erev Rav, or those who left as well, they also stood by Mount Sinai. They also apparently said Naaseh V'Nishma. They also were part of the community at that point. So to what extent are you going to have a clear Erev Rav? So yes, in Chazal you do, and going all the way up to today, Erev Rav is going to be a term which is going to be used in mystical or semi-mystical literature to describe the people who you believe are pretenders and not the real Jews. And by the way it's used in more current sources, it doesn't make a difference what the person's genealogy was, doesn't make a difference where they came from, but if they are pretenders, or you decide they're pretenders, that's far more important. You decide they're pretenders, then at that point they become the Erev Rav and are these dangerous interlopers who are causing all kinds of terrible spiritual things. So all that you, this is one of the ways we can decide what kind of Jew you are. You just tell me who your Erev Rav are, and now we know who you are, right? That's how we define things. But it's wonderful. It is so wonderful in life to have people you can blame for all of your problems and mistakes. It wasn't me. It wasn't us. It was the Erev Rav. They did this. We're perfectly fine, and so on. Well, that's why she got married. That's what you said. That's why he got married. Be careful. She let you sit next to her. This is, don't take this as a given. It's never too late for marriage counseling, you know? And yes, you can take boys out of Brooklyn. We'll just leave it at that. So, I'm saying that's one side of things, is that we have someone, yeah, they did these terrible, they worshipped idolatry, they did terrible things, as we'll see in a moment, but it wasn't them, it was just the Erev Rav. Now, if it really was just the Erev Rav, why are the Jews responsible for this? Why does God say to Moshe, that's it, I'm wiping out the entire people? So you'd have to say, well, God is extreme in his response. All the Jews would have done in such a case was stand on the sidelines and not protest too much. So you're saying that because the Jews stood on the side and didn't protest, that's the reason God says to Moshe, I'm going to destroy the entire people and make a new nation out of you. So I'll say it again, is that I love having people to blame. I think all of us should always have people that we can blame. And it's a wonderful strategy, and it'll make you very happy in life. But I just have a hard time actually reading this when I say looking at the larger context of what's going on. However, just to give a little bit of support, I don't want to give too much, but a little bit of support, is something which is much more of a Bamidbar issue than it is a Shemot issue, and that is which term is used for the people here, and it says Vayakahel Ha'am. So who is the Am? Who is the nation? But not again, I'm going to say it again. Ha'am really much, it really does sound like it's the people, it's the Jewish people, but if you want to counter and say, well, then maybe it should have said B'nai Yisrael. Maybe it should have said Yisrael. Maybe it should have said something. And Ha'am, maybe you can say something. Later on, God will say to Moshe, your people, and that's where they say, oh, your people, the one that you took out, and therefore you're responsible, and that's when they get to, because Moshe allowed for that Erev to come out. But I'm going to say it again. The whole thing is difficult. Now, the other way to get out of all of this is now to read the next phrase. Aseh lanu Elohim. So what exactly does the word Elohim mean? So I guess some people, if they're really, really religious, they'll say Elohim over here. But of course, that is an absurdity because this is not talking about God. Aseh lanu Elohim is not a very... So what is it they asked for? So there are those who will argue, many, many of the Rishonim, especially from Ashkenaz, who will argue that they just ask for a judge. See, the word Elohim means someone of something or someone, something of power. And there are times that the word Elohim specifically means judge. So Moshe's not here. Moshe's been the judge. So therefore, Moshe's not here. Say lenu Elohim, ashayechu lefanenu. Make for us a judge. We'll go in for us. Kizeh Moshe ha'ish. Now we're reading a little bit more. Kizeh Moshe ha'ish ashayelonu me'eretz Mitzrayim lo yodana mehayalo. Because this man Moshe who took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. Now, the truth is that we've already just now run into a terrible theological issue, aside from the implication of their asking for idolatry. First of all, the word ha'ish connected to Moshe is really most interesting over here. Because Moshe is and will be described many, many ways. This is the only time that there's an emphasis, Moshe ha'ish, Moshe the man. I mean, it could have, or perhaps it should have said, Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, that's not really a biblical term, right? Moshe, our leader, Moshe something. I mean, there just should have been some other term. The emphasis on Moshe the man, and this is not the vernacular, he's the man. This is not what it says over here. It's Moshe the man over here. Now, just think of that comparison. It's Aseh lanu Elohim, make for us whatever Elohim means, ki Moshe ish. But again, I'm pausing there. So there are those who want to take that little part out. Hold it. If Moshe is just a man, then what's Aseh lanu Elohim? It must be another man, and therefore Moshe is the judge who took us out. We need a new judge. And yes, there are a lot who want to read it that way. Now, if that's the case, and they only ask for a judge, then why does Aaron make a golden calf? And I just now made an assumption. Does Aaron really make the golden calf? Or I'll say this a little differently. How did all of this end up in a golden calf if they just didn't ask for a judge, unless you're going to say, well, Aaron completely misunderstood what's going on, and Aaron decided, oh, they want a golden calf over here, and let me do that for them. But again, I've made an assumption that it was really Aaron that made it, and that may not be the case at all. But I can just as easily read it in the opposite way. I can read it in what it really says. Aseh lanu Elohim, make for us some kind of a deity, make for us some kind of a god. Why? Because Moshe, who took us out, is a man, and Moshe is fickle, and Moshe is here today, gone tomorrow, and it's very frustrating, and we want something which is far more permanent, that's going to be something that we can use as our leadership. And again, moving back and reverting back to pagan kinds of forms of behavior and modes of religion and modes of worship, which perhaps they were accustomed to or used to or they saw while they were in Egypt. So therefore the suggestion, okay, Moshe's not here, now let's, or even better, Moshe's not here, now we can get away with doing it if we wanted to, which is much more the way that it sounds, as opposed to saying, no, just get us a judge. But I'll say it again, two forms of cover-up. One is to say it was Avodah Zarah, it was idolatry, but it wasn't them. And the other say, no, it wasn't idolatry, but it was them. And of course, we know that the reality is that it was idolatry and it was them. So therefore, if you prefer the cover-ups, you don't have to listen to anything else that I'm going to say today. You've already know all the answers before I ask any questions. But nonetheless, I think it's worthwhile pursuing a little more because for no other reason, you're already here. So let's continue. The thing, the turn of phrase, which is actually far more concerning than I led on to the first time, is when they say, Moshe who took us out of Egypt, because they actually could have given credit to something or someone else or something else that took them out of Egypt, and that is God. Which actually leads us to a whole nother issue, and that is, what really was the end game of this eventual golden calf? Was it to replace Moshe, or was it to replace God? And that, by the way, is the third cop-out that takes place. No, it was never really to replace God. There's no real idolatry going over here. It's only that they wanted to replace Moshe, and meaning, yes, it was idolatry, but it was only to replace Moshe because they needed some way to connect to God. And by the way, if I wanted to try to justify that more than I should, I can ask you an annoying question, and the annoying question, which you've probably heard from me before, but at least a year's gone by, and that is, when it comes down to what's the difference between the kruvim, the cherubs, which were put inside the Mishkan, where God says, make these things, versus the egel, that's made of gold, and this is made of gold. What's the difference between a golden calf and golden cherubs? And if the whole answer comes down to Simon says, right, this God said to do, and this God said not to do, so that means that in terms of essence, there is no difference, and it only comes down to being commanded. And maybe that's the difference between a mitzvah and a avodah zarah. What's a avodah zarah? It's a service that you were not asked for. So maybe it comes down to that, but still, there's something which is troublesome about that nonetheless. So as I said, I gave you three different ways out. One, you can blame the heir of Rav, and they really did terrible things. Two is that you can say that it was them, but they only asked for a judge. Or finally, you can say it was them, but they weren't trying to replace God. They were only trying to replace Moshe. But again, now let me point out, they said something. They actually say two opposite things about Moshe in one turn of phrase. One is Moshe Ish, and the second, Hashem Eleinu Meir Mitzrayim. So have they really underestimated Moshe on the one hand, and have they actually overstated Moshe's role on the other hand? I mean, that's great. To do that in one turn of phrase is great, because there's something else that I wanted you to keep in mind, and that was when they met God at Mount Sinai, and God says, I am God. You actually should have that here at some place. If you look, kind of wanted it to. Yeah, sorry. Right, the second source. Yes, it's not only is it here; it's in the right place. This is quite unusual and shocking. Anochi Hashem Elokecha Hashem Hutzitecha Me'eretz Yitzrayim. I am the God, the Lord your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt. So now, why are they saying that it was Moshe who took them out of Egypt? So therefore, on the one hand, they say it's Moshe is only a man. And secondly, they're saying Moshe took us out. Why not say no? God took us out, which means again going to this point: who are they trying to replace? And if you're not so sure on this point, let's continue in the first source, because we've only got two-thirds of the way through the first verse. It ends up by saying, Lo yadanu mehayalo. We don't know what happened to him. Now, it occurred to me, just in case you need to know this, that this part, what I'm going to say, or I'm going to eventually get to, is new. But it occurred to me that there may be something deeper to this point about we don't know what happened to Moshe. And I want to say it like this. There may actually be guilt involved in this. But I'm not explaining that yet. When I explain it, I will tell you I'm explaining it, but not yet. So Aaron will go into what Rashi identifies as three different tactics in terms of a delay strategy, right? There's a difference between strategy versus tactics. The strategy is the delay. The tactics are what's used to fulfill the strategy. So therefore, what does he actually do? First thing. He says, "Vayomer aleim Aharon, pirku nizmei hazahav asher boznei nesheichem b'neichem uvenoteichem v'viyu alai." Sure, bring me your wife's jewelry, which I think Aaron is assuming you'll have a bunch of men beaten up and say, "Well, that didn't work out very well." So I hope you all appreciate that this is a delay tactic. You want you want something? Great, go get your wives to give all the jewelry, and this will work out great. So that's delay tactic number one, and I hope you all appreciate this. But it says, "V'yitperku kol ha'am et nizmei hazahav asher ba'ozneihem v'yivyu el Aaron." And all the people, again, the word "am" is used here, and I don't know about the Am, if it's the males or the females, if the women were included or not included. Again, you have this wonderful rabbinic approach that the women were not involved in the sin, but you can argue this either way. And maybe just the men gave all their jewelry, but it says that the donations came flying in, and therefore that tactic seems to have not as worked as well as we would have thought. Vayikach miyadam, vayitzar oto b'chei, right? Notice vayitzar is he formed it, and that's in the singular. Vayasehu egel masecha. So now whatever this word vayasehu means is going to be the problem, is what I'm not even going to bother. I mean, grammar is for other people, but the vayasehu is a difficult word, and it does not make it. It's a very interesting construction, but it doesn't sound like Aaron did it. Vayomru, and then they say, Elu Elohecha Yisrael Asher Luchem Eretz Yisrael. This is the God that took you out of Egypt. So now I have to say to myself, hold it. Didn't they just say that it was Moshe took out of Egypt? And even when they said it was Moshe took them out of Egypt, wasn't it really the God who took them out of Egypt? And now that they've built this thing, so now tell me, who are they replacing? Are they replacing God or are they replacing Moshe? Which means they did this wonderfully impossible thing in one turn of phrase, devaluing Moshe, turning into Moshe Ha'ish, and then valuing Moshe who took us out, but now revealing that it was really this thing that took them out, and now you realize that God just now has been thrust aside, pushed aside, and therefore, as much as people want to claim that this whole purpose of this Egel is to replace Moshe, I think it's very hard to say in light of this somewhat unknown text called the Ten Commandments. So, I mean, that's something which is somewhat unfortunate. So let's continue a little bit more. Vayar Aharon, and Aharon sees this, and by the way, the rabbis in the Talmud read into this seeing something far more frightening, and they see that he sees something that has taken place. We will pause for a moment and look at source number 5. Vayar Aharon, Aaron sees this, Vayivin Mizbeach Lefanav, so we'll have to come back to that in a moment. Mara'a, what did he see? Because it's the wrong word. It shouldn't say he saw. I mean, Vayar, it says, Mara'a Amu Rabbi Binyamin Bar Yefet, Amu Rabbi Elazar, Ra'a Chur Shezavuach Lefanav. He saw Chur, who was just now slaughtered in front. And slaughtered is an interesting word here. Zavuach, because it does have a connotation of an offering. So what exactly happened to this, happened over here? So before Moshe goes up, he says to the people, I'm leaving Aaron and Hur in charge. That was the end of chapter 24. Who exactly are Aaron and Hur and why are they significant? So you need to go back a couple chapters before that, back to chapter 17, when we had the war against Amalek. Yoshua is the one who's leading the battle below. Moshe goes up on the top of the hill, and there are two people, his right hand and his left hand man, one holding up his right hand and one holding up his left hand. One is Aaron and one is Hur. So these are two very prominent individuals. And Moshe, when he goes up the mountain, now Yoshua comes halfway up the mountain with them, and the others stay below, and he says, okay, any issues, go to them. So, by the way, very simple, logical thing. If Moshe's not here, Moshe's gone, you need a replacement, who do you go to? You either appoint Aaron or your point Hur. If you're going to claim that you just need a new judge, Elohim means judge, so just appoint Aaron, appoint Hur. If you're going to argue that Aaron will become the Kohen and he's going to be the one with religious, so then you appoint Hur as the man who should be king. By the way, just to make this suggestion even more politically desirable, Hur is from the tribe of Yehuda, and eventually the kingship of David will come out of the same family. Hur's grandson is Bezalel, the one who will build the Mishkan. David's son is the one who builds the Beit HaMikdash. The Ben David is the one who builds the temple. And therefore, Hur, of course, is the perfect candidate to have taken over. But Hur disappears. We never see Hur again in the Torah. So it's very strange. That's what's bothering the Talmud over here. On the one hand, Moshe says, if there's any issues, then go to Hur and Aaron. They come to Aaron, why don't they go to Hur? So now the Talmud reads between the lines and tells us something completely ominous, and it says that they came to Hur, and Hur is there as this is taking place, and when they make the golden calf, at that point Hur protests, and they kill him. Yeah, meaning that's the problem. I'm going to read the words again in source number 5. What did he see? Ra'achur shezavuach lefanav. He sees Chor, who was just slaughtered by this mob, lying and bleeding to death in front of him. Amar, ilo shama'ana lahu hashta, if I don't listen to them now, avdu li kita avdu bachor, they will do to me as they did to Chor. Umekayim bi, and regarding me, they're going to fulfill the verse in Eicha. Of course, Eicha is the book, not for the building of the temple, like Bezalel, but it's the book about the destruction of the temple. Im yaharog b'mikdash Hashem kohen v'navi. And because you have killed in the temple of God, you've killed both the Kohen and the Navi. And he says, now they've killed the Navi, and if they kill me, they'll kill the Kohen as well. And therefore, Aaron stops. V'lo havi le takante la'olam. They'll never be able to fix this stain on the collective Jewish community, which, by the way, again, the Erev Rav argument is not here. They will never be able to fix this stain. Mutav de la avdi la egla. It's better for me to be involved in the service of the egel. Efshar havi le takante b'tshuva. And then maybe they can yet fix this and do tshuva and to heal it. So again, it's a very frightening passage in the Talmud, but it goes back to what we were up to, Vayar Aaron. Aaron sees this, Vayivan Mizbeach Lefanav, and he builds an altar. Now Rashi reads into this a different tactic, and he says that the building of the altar is something which was deliberate and took time, and Aaron says this has to be done nicely, it has to be done well. If we're already going to do it, you have to do it right. And Aaron delays and does this as slow as possible, saying to himself, I'm sure that Moshe is going to be back any second. Meaning he's sure Moshe is going to be back, and they not. So therefore, again, so for two delaying tactics. One tactic was saying bring the jewelry, and he figures that should end the whole thing, but it didn't. So now he builds the Mizbeach very slowly and deliberately, which of course you can say, Aaron, how are you doing this? So that's what the Talmud comes in and says, well, excuse me, he just saw that they murdered one guy, so therefore it's going to happen, so let me be a part of it. But again, even though he's a part of it, he wants to try to delay it. So that's reading Rashi together with what we just now saw. A little bit more. Vayikra Aaron, and he calls to them and he says, Vayomar Chag LaHashem Machar. Tomorrow will be a day of celebration, a holiday for God tomorrow. And notice over here, he doesn't say for the Egel, he says for God. Chag LaHashem Machar. And this is his third tactic in terms of delay, where he has pushed them off and says, okay, tomorrow is going to be a holiday. So instead of right now, I mean, it's actually a brilliant thing to do when you have this mob who's all worked up and all excited. Okay, give them something to do. Go back and get the jewelry. Doesn't think that's going to work out. Okay, we need to build the Mizbeach really right. We're going to, essentially, what's he doing? Delayed gratification, which means when you have people who want immediate gratification, which is very much part of what idolatry is, so let's delay the gratification as much as possible. And that is what he does, and he declares Chag LaHashem Machar. Rashi once again will tell us that the tactic over here is one of delay, and he's convinced that by tomorrow Moshe is going to come back. And in fact, Moshe does come back, but they're in the middle of celebrating and this golden calf. But one more verse 6, Pasuk Vav, V'yashkimu mimacharat. So this is the day that everybody gets up early. They get up as early as possible. Vayishkimu mimacharat. Vayalehu olot, and they bring burnt offerings. Vayagishu shlamim, and they bring peace offerings. Vayeshev ha'am, and the people sit le'echol, to eat. Vishatu, and they drink. Vayakumu, and they stand up litzachek, in order to party. Which Rashi over here, let's finally get to Rashi. Let's go to source number 6. I want to start by the end, and then we'll go backwards. The end is all the way. Look in Pasuk Vav. It's 3 lines before the end. It says, Vayashkimu hasatan zerzam. It was the devil, as it were, that woke them up early. Fascinating, but we're going to come back to that. Kidei sheyechta'u. The devil made me do it. Flip Wilson. Vayashkimu hasatan zerzam kidei sheyechta'u. Litzachek. I would translate this as they made merry. And you're saying, who's Mary? V'litzachek yesh b'mashma hazeh, implied in this is gilei arayot, that sexual outrage took place over there, that this was not just a party, this was a party. K'mo shenemar litzachek bi, moving over to the narrative with Mrs. Potiphar and Yosef, and says this slave came litzachekbi, and the term used. So there's more than one usage of litzachek and with this connotation to it, and therefore the implication over here is that they were guilty of sexual outrage over here, but they were also guilty of a couple of other things over here, which means we started with one sin, and that is the sin of idolatry. And now, before we knew it, we just now read and weaved into this as well the sins of murder, of horror, and also of a whole sexual outrage as well. So over here, you have essentially what we can call the three major sins in Judaism are all being perpetrated at the foot of Mount Sinai, a couple of days, weeks after the Jews received the Ten Commandments directly from God at Mount Sinai. And this is something, when I started, I said that, you know, the events in this week's parsha are preposterous. I'm not saying they didn't happen. I'm just saying they're preposterous, because we would like to believe that if only we stood by Mount Sinai and we heard God speak and we saw God speak and we had such an experience, we would love to believe that we would be more serious than they were. But obviously, there's a deeper point over here, and it's part of what we need to get to. I want to say it over superficially first, but as we proceed, I want to try to say it somewhat deeper. If they were not able to sin because of the experience that they just now had, then their belief would be of no meaning whatsoever. Belief is only of meaning when there is an alternative. If we were all just robots programmed to do certain behaviors, then what is the significance of the behaviors that we do? Which means I could have thought that the people who stood at Mount Sinai had no choice but to believe. They had no choice but to do what's right. So therefore, by virtue of their sinning at Mount Sinai and making this whole outrageous party and celebrating the antithesis of what they just now experienced, if nothing else tells me that these are still human beings who still have free will. Now if you prefer and say, well, look at that, it was the Satan there. Well, Rashi actually goes down the Satan route a couple of times. Go back towards the beginning now of source 6. Ki boshesh Moshe. Moshe delayed in coming down. Ki targumo lashon ichur. He came down late, delayed. V'shishasar ba satan ve'irbev et olam. The confusion, irbev, confusion that took place was due to Satan. A couple of lines later, it's going to tell us that Kize Moshe Ha'ish, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines down. Kize Moshe Ha'ish, Kimin Dmut Moshe Harelahem HaSatan. Again, he throws the Satan into the narrative here. Satan shows them an image of Moshe's body, Shenosim Otob Avira Kiyab HaShemayim. And they show Moshe's remains that have been now carried away. So therefore, Rashi over here is doing something which maybe some of you feel uncomfortable with, and that is saying, oh, look how Satan is involved in all of this. But again, I want to remind you of something. In Jewish theology, Satan is in the service of God. Satan is this thing which God creates in order for us to be able to have free will. If you want, look at source 26. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Hu Satan, Hu Yetzer Hara, Hu Malach HaMavet. This is all the same character. Satan, the evil incarnation, or the angel of death, all of these are the same. The next line of the Gemara, which I cut out, is a couple of cases where people were actually realized. Somebody gave a talk, and he realized that the Satan was just there in order to be rejected. Satan is just there in order to give us choices. And it says that he mentioned this in a lecture, and Satan walked into the room and kissed him on his feet and says, you know, you finally figured out who I am, right? So very much unlike, maybe we can credit the Rolling Stones to a little extent over here, sympathy for the devil. But over here, it's this understanding of what's really going on. Because again, let's remind ourselves of something. We believe in monotheism. Monotheism means we believe in one God. If we believe in one God, then the Satan, whatever this is not an independent contractor. He's not somebody who has independent power. Any power that it could have is because God gives that power. So therefore, what exactly was Reish Lakish telling us? That sometimes it feels like an external thing, and sometimes it feels like an internal thing. Sometimes it is the Satan outside tempting, and sometimes the Yetzer Hara inside. But essentially, it is this thing which gives us our free will. So again, I'm going to go back and say that the people who stood at Mount Sinai, and this part is what I want to try to get to. At Mount Sinai, there is a tradition that the Jews only heard the first two of the Ten Commandments. And at that point, they were overwhelmed, and they said, no, you just have to stop. Now, that is based upon a verse which is hopefully right over here. Source number 7, chapter 20, verse 15, Perikav, Pasuk Tedvav. V'chol ha'am ro'im et ha'kolot, and all the people see the sounds, v'et ha'lapidim, v'et kol ha'shofar, and it's the lightning, and it's the sound of the shofar, v'et ha'har ha'shen, the mountain is full of smoke. Very, very frightening vision. V'yar ha'am, the people see, v'yanu, and they start to shake, which means the experience at Sinai is frightening. V'yamdu mirachok, and they recoil, and they stand at a distance. Vayomu Moshe, daber ata imanu v'nishma'a. You speak to us, and we'll hear. Va'al yedaber imanu elokim pein namut. And let God not speak to us anymore, lest we die. So there is this acknowledgement that this experience of Sinai is so intense that if God speaks to them, they are all going to die, and they just can't take this anymore. So I'm going to say it again. The rabbis understood that this is after the first two commandments, and the reason for this is actually a grammatical difference between the way the first two commandments are stated versus the other eight commandments. You have a chance, you'll take a look, and then you'll hopefully will understand that, but it's the way that God speaks in first person in the first two as opposed to the others. So because they're said differently, therefore this tradition is coupled with the people's hesitation, and therefore it's understood that God said to them the first two, at which point they turn to Moshe and they say, no, you just have to stop this, we can't take this anymore. So I want to say something about the Ten Commandments, which I've said before, and now I hope is going to go a little bit deeper, because it may actually explain something. And then I want to get back to the guilt that they have, because there is guilt over here. And sometimes, you know, guilt is such an unhealthy feeling. Listen, let's be honest. Sometimes we do things which are wrong, and we need to feel that we're wrong. But you can't feel that you're wrong and therefore just give up. You need to feel that you've done something wrong, and now how do I fix this? Yes, the narcissist sociopath is going to forgive themselves very, very quickly and then just move on to their next victim. But regular people should feel, if something is wrong, hold it. There's something which is wrong here. Now, how do we fix it? Rather than saying there's something wrong here and it's over. It just can't ever be fixed. I mean, that's not the way that this world works. The way this world works is we all make mistakes. We all do things that we wish we didn't do. But we all need to feel that things can be healed and things can be fixed. And that's essential, because that feeling of guilt whereby it just can't be fixed anymore, I think that ends up becoming devastating, but I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. So let me get back to the point about the Ten Commandments. There is this remarkable teaching. Now, Rashi actually says it, but of course he doesn't say it in the Chumash. People don't know it as well. He says it out nowhere in Shir HaShirim, and it's based upon a Midrash, but I prefer to bring the Rashi rather than the Midrash. So let's take a look. Now, this is what the verse actually says. Shnei shadayich kishnei afarim tu'umet zviya haro'im bashoshanim. Now, some people don't like to translate this because of the general erotic nature of Shir HaShirim, and it actually does start saying, your two breasts are like, if you look, this is one of the things that Art Squirrel got the most, what's the word, guilt, not guilt, they got shamed for the most. And that is, they refuse to translate it, what the words actually say, and instead they follow something which Rashi says. If you look, Shnei Shadayach, your two breasts, Rashi says, Haminikot Otach, who give sustenance to you, Ze Moshe V'Aaron. Moshe and Aaron are the two things which nurture the Jewish people, Moshe in terms of Torah and Aaron in terms of the Kahuna. So therefore, their English translation here writes, instead of your two breasts, write your two leaders, Moshe and Aaron. which is nice to tell you what something means, but you'd rather have a translation first, even if you want to try to sell that as your translation. So therefore, what they went for, but by the way, the attack on them was unfair, because in the very beginning of the book, they say that we're not doing a direct translation, we're doing a translation based upon what things mean, rather on what things say, which is also fair if you write it. So therefore, for all the people who chose, you know, to make fun of the article translation for this, it wasn't a translation, it was an attempt to explain. And I'm saying the same attack you could have put on Rashi right over here as well. But then Rashi gives a second. Yeah, of course. So then Rashi, yes, of course. So now you can't make fun of art school. See that? So when you look now at the continuation of Rashi, he says something interesting. Kishnei afarim to meit sivya, derech sivya, I'm going to skip a little bit. Liyot yoledet to umim, kach shneim shavim shkulim zekin. Because it's as if it was like two deer and two things that look like twins. Davar afe shnei shadayach al shem haluchot, that the two breasts that we're talking about are related to the Ten Commandments, to the luchot, to the two tablets of stone. Now that itself is completely unexpected and perhaps surprising. And there's probably a lot more to say about this. If we were not so puritanical, I would, but we are, so I won't. And it says, Shehem mechuvanot b'midah achat, v'chamisha dibrot alzu, v'chamisha alzu, mechuvanim dibur k'neged dibur. So it says that the two tablets of stone are completely symmetrical one to the other, five on one side and five on the other side. And then what he's telling us, and I'll say very clearly in the next two lines, is that therefore the way to read the Ten Commandments is not to read them from top to bottom. The way to read them is across. That you read the Ten Commandments across, and then something new will emerge as you read. Anochi keneged lo tirtzach. I am God, right? If we look again at source number two, Anochi Hashem Lakecha Shotzicha Me'eretz Yisrael. I am God who took you out of the land of Egypt, right? Mibet Avadim, from the house of slavery, should be read together with do not commit murder. And Rashi explains more. Why? Sheharotzeach Mimayet Tadmut Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because man is created in the image of God. To kill a human being is somehow to stamp out some godliness in this world, because every single human being has godliness. By the way, it's an incredibly important teaching, not just Jews. Every human being in this world is created the image of God, and therefore the act of murder is extinguishing some degree of manifest godliness in this world. Not saying every person is a god, absolutely not, but saying every person is the image of God, and therefore holiness. But this is fascinating. I am God, took out of Egypt, now read across, and do not commit murder. Do not commit murder. Why? Because I am God. Why not commit murder? Because I've given human beings, I've endowed them with some type of spirituality, and therefore the holiness of human beings. Now that's itself is a fascinating read. Let's just do one more. The rest can be for your homework if you so choose. Lo yelecha, do not worship other gods, and so on. Keneged lo tinaf, reads across, do not commit adultery. So committing adultery is cheating on one's spouse. Over here it's cheating on God, and it's also is saying, just read them across, and this will give you more insight. So let's stop right there for a moment. And, you know, we've blamed everybody so far. We've blamed the heir of Rav. We've blamed Aaron. We've blamed, I don't know, who else do you want to blame? Blame the people. So let's finally get down to it, and let's blame God, right? This is all God's fault to begin with, right? So why would I say this is God's fault? So I didn't have time to go and to do research on this. I'm sure all of you can, and you'll find countless studies. I actually did take advantage of Naomi driving me this morning, but we were talking, and I had to be polite. But so I only got to one article on it, but I'm sure one could easily find 10 or 100 or more than that. And to what degree saying that you shouldn't do something creates within people the desire to do something? So the example, actually, the first example that came up there, it all comes down to how you Google and what you search for and so on, but the first example that came up was the prohibition. So how well did the prohibition work in the United States to get rid of the alcohol industry, or did it actually turn it into forbidden fruit? And by the way, that's a very important term, specifically in terms of what we're discussing. How did that instead turn into forbidden fruit and then create much more of a market ultimately for alcohol. Which means, why in the world did we decide that we're going to reject the first two commandments? Because those are the two commandments that we heard. But I'm missing something. And by the way, I just want to extend this now. If we really did hear those first two commandments, those first two commandments are actually connected to two more commandments. So now just realize what I just now did. They rejected I am God, took it out of the land of Egypt, and they made a graven image, but they also went against the two things that go across that, and they committed murder, and they also were guilty of the sexual outrage over there. Which means this teaching of Rashi just now went in a way that I don't know, again, I don't know if Rashi imagined the way that I just now applied it, that this is what happened by the foot of the mountain. And whose fault is all of this? Of course, it's God's fault. Because what did God do? God said, don't do this. And what happens when someone says, don't do this? That's, of course, what you want to do. I mean, have you ever met, human beings? I mean, I could say teenagers, but it's not fair. Because it is the forbidden fruit. Or for that matter, why in the world did Adam and Eve want to eat from that tree? Because God said, don't eat from that tree. Come on. It's like saying, you want to get your kid to eat vegetables? No, you cannot have vegetables. I mean, it's probably the only way to make it happen. But this is actually, if you think about it, why do they go there? Well, they go there because God said not to go there. And therefore, whose fault is this? It's God's fault, but I'm missing something in all of this. Because I told you, I think that there's some guilt involved in this, and is that guilt that we still need to understand, you know, where that guilt came from and how this is manifest and what's taking place. Now, if we start all over again from the beginning, the first verse says, Vayara am ki boshesh Moshe. They see that Moshe delayed in coming down, leredet min ahar. Vikahela am al Aaron. They gather on Aaron. Again, the violence. Vayoma ilav kuma se lenuhim. And now they go against the Ten Commandments, make for us a God. Right? So that, again, within one verse, they went against two of the Ten Commandments by saying it was Moshe who took us out, when it was God who took us out, make us a God, make us a graven image. God said not to make a graven image. And what they also did along the way is that they devalued Moshe, because there's all kinds of other things they could have said about Moshe. But I think that there's a deeper point to all of this, and that goes back to the guilt. And what exactly is the guilt? The guilt is that they think they just killed Moshe. Now, you can now say to yourselves, why would they think they just killed Moshe? And the answer is because they did. Now, I want to say this in a way which is understandable. Well, they killed Moshe in terms of the dialogue, in terms of the language. They just killed him because Moshe, as we know, is very much alive. Moshe is up on Mount Sinai. And Moshe is thriving. Moshe is hanging out with God. Moshe is receiving spiritual sustenance. Moshe is going to bring all that down to earth. So Moshe is alive and well, but they just now killed him. But why did they just now kill him? And the answer is because they think they killed him. So now, let me go back and try to explain that point. We just now read before this that when God is speaking, it's so intense. And what do they say? If God continues to speak to us, we are going to die. Right? Because God speaking to man is something which is impossible. And just stop. Rather, you speak to us. Now, that's really interesting. You speak to us based on what? Based upon God speaking to you. So therefore, they're watching all the frightening things it says that they see. They see the mountain, they see the lightning, the thunder, and the smoke. And then Moshe, because they told him, goes up and climbs into this. Which means, what was the alternative? The alternative was that God should have said to them, not just all Ten Commandments, God should have taught them whatever it is they need to speak. Moshe never should have left them for 40 days and 40 nights. Moshe leaves them because they don't want to hear God say anything to them anymore. Why? Because they may die. So Moshe, we may die. You go. So now, I just continue that thought for a second. So Moshe goes, and what happens? He doesn't come back. So why doesn't Moshe come back? Presume because he died. So I'm just, all of that was obvious. I just added one little piece to all of this, which of course is the most frightening piece. And what is that? That Moshe went because they sent him. So now they're standing over here thinking to themselves, of course Moshe is dead because a person can't survive this. And every day that goes by confirms within them the clear idea that Moshe is actually dead. But if Moshe is actually dead, then who's guilty of killing them? And the answer is that they are, because they never should have let him go on this mission. They never should have let him go up the mountain. They never should have let him go to some place which is so dangerous. They never should have allowed him, because ultimately Moshe is just a man. He's just a man like everybody else. But why do they stress over here Moshe Ish? It's Moshe Ish because he's now dead. But that's why I want to get back to this point about the guilt. If you're convinced you just now killed Moshe Rabbeinu, if you're convinced you just now killed Moshe because you sent him on an impossible suicide mission, so now what happens at this point? So at this point, I think they get into total depression. Again, if you want to say that I'm guilty now of trying to exonerate them, then come on. These are people who've been through an enormous amount. You know, there's a midrash which questions, why does it start Anochi? I am God who? Which means if you're writing the script right now, how do you write, I am God? What it should have or could have or should have said is, I am God who created heaven and earth. It's far more impressive, right? I am the all-powerful, right? Go to the Wizard of Oz. I am the all-powerful, I am God who created heaven and earth. That's what it should have said. But it doesn't say that. Instead, it starts the relationship in really a remarkable way, and it says, hi, I'm God who took you. Again, I'll read the words so I don't get accused of making this up. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am God, your God. By the way, there's a personal thing in that. It could have been, I am the God who created heaven and earth, and then there would be a separation. Ani Hashem Elokecha. Right? I am God, right? Your God. Asher Hotzaticha Meretzayim, who took you out of Egypt, mi Beit Avadim, from the house of slavery. Do you realize what's acknowledged in this? And by the way, what I'm saying right now, I'm taking it from a notebook from my great-grandfather, which my father has at home. And he was a rabbi in the Lower East Side before that. He was a rabbi of Riminov. And he, again, I'm not going to the whole depth of what he says, but the acknowledgement over here is that the people were slaves and the people are scarred and the people went through incredible difficulties. And the people are suffering from post-traumatic stress because of what they've gone through for all this time. And as soon as God introduces himself, what does he say? He goes, hi, I'm God. Again, background, I create heaven and earth, but he doesn't say that. And I'm the one who took you out of slavery, which means there is a direct acknowledgement that they had been slaves. This is a direct acknowledgement of what they've gone through, which means ultimately when Moshe is going to pray and argue for the people to continue, that's going to be a good part of the argument is, so what do you want from them? What did you expect of them? But my point is that they are suffering from post-traumatic stress, but at least they have Moshe Rabbeinu. And now they don't even have Moshe Rabbeinu. And why don't they have Moshe Rabbeinu? Because they just killed Moshe Rabbeinu. And I'll go a little bit further. I think that the thought that they may have felt guilt for killing Moshe may have opened the doors to kill Hor afterwards as well. Because once you're guilty of murder, once you've done, you think that you've done all kinds of outrageous things that you could never be forgiven for. That's part of what's important. This is all not forgiven. So therefore, what could we do? So the very things that God said to do are the exact things that God said, that they decide that they're going to do the opposite. And if God says, I took you out of Egypt, they don't acknowledge that. No, it's Moshe took us out of Egypt. And don't make a graven image. We're going to make a graven image. And I'm going to again claim, yes, forget the error of Rav and forget that they just want a new leader. They are going against the very things that God said, because this is what God said, because essentially they just now gave up. And why do they give up? Because they just now, they think they just now did the worst thing that anybody can ever do. And therefore, just throw everything away. There is going to be no holiness. There is going to be no Jewish people. There is going to be no relationship with God. Let us just go back because we just killed Moshe Rabbeinu. And now they have to go and deal with having murdered Moshe. Even though I'm going to go back and say, but they didn't do this. This came from their own fear. Their own fear was, we can't stand in front of God. Maybe we're undeserving. Maybe we're not on a high enough level. But now they've come to this realization, if Moshe's not coming back, then Moshe was just a person also. Even though they know how, again, just think about that. What am I really doing? Think of that incredible contradiction. On the one hand, they say, Moshe Ish, who took us out of Egypt. I mean, which one is it? Is it Moshe Ish? Is Moshe just a man? Or Moshe took us out of Egypt? And it's both, because now in this new narrative that they're creating, God is completely outside of the narrative. And now they can then you know, just like Moshe took us out. Okay, so the golden calf took us out. It's that God, it's that what they're doing is they're rebelling against whatever God said. And now what I pointed out is not only do they rebel against what God says, but even the logical conclusion of what God says, and that's the two sides of the commandments, when you read them across, that not only is it going to be against God, it's also then going to be against murder. Not only is it going to be against idolatry, it's also going to go into the sexual sins, and therefore what creates this? So the reality is this is the Yetzer Hara. This is the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara over here is creating for them an alternative universe whereby you have this whole image of good and decency and holiness, and now with the Satan getting involved and showing Moshe's dead body and Moshe's dead and so on and so forth, and now an alternative universe is created. So now there is free choice again, which means part of what I'm getting at is actually articulated incredibly in source number 29 by the Tiferet Yisrael, which is the Maharal. He goes, Achar shehit ba'er l'cha ha-madriga he'elyona shehigil Yisrael. You know, after we come to explain the incredible high level the Jews got at when they stood at Mount Sinai, hinei l'fanenu she'la atzuma ma'od. Then you can ask this incredibly strong question. Eich tekef umiyad saru maher min aderech. How is it possible after these people stood at Mount Sinai that immediately they go vasulem egel masecha and they make a golden calf? And by the way, this is how I started today. How is it possible that people stood at Mount Sinai can go and get to such a level? V'davar zeh she'la gedola ma'od. He goes on, this is an enormous question. He goes on to say, and I'm not going to read, it's actually the whole chapter you need to read with the footnotes. So we're not going to read the whole thing, but essentially what he's going to claim is specifically when you get to very high levels is when there has to be something else which can then bring you down from that. Otherwise, you cease to be a human in the sense of having this free choice and having other possibilities, which means, and I'm going to say it's slightly different, in order for the world to be a very fair place, there needs to be this other possibility. Again, the paradigm for all of this could very well be when Adam was created and God is there, Adam and Eve, Garden of Eden, everything is perfect. And then you have a manifestation of the Yetzer Hara coming as a serpent, as something which is external. Oh, no, no, eat from the tree, you'll be okay. And the truth is, and I'm not going to work this out the way that I should, but by the same sin, you're going to end up having the same kinds of things, a sin of idolatry, a sin of sexuality, and a sin of murder. And I say murder, why? Because now death comes into the world and all human beings are going to die eventually. And the same thing comes up, and I already hinted at it before. Why do they want to eat from this tree? Because God said, don't eat from the tree. Which means at the same moment that we're going to get a revelation and God saying, oh, this tree is bad for you, or these things are the laws you need to follow, it's at that moment that there has to necessarily be a possibility, or even something more than a possibility, something pulling us in the direction of the antithesis of the very revelation that you received. Otherwise, what free choice do we have, and what kind of human beings are we if we don't have free choice? So he's saying is specifically when man reaches the apex, we get to the highest level of spiritual enlightenment, it's specifically at that moment that some other power is created that then causes doubt and causes questioning and you know, what is going on over here. And that role is filled in, you know, the Rashi that we looked at, that is the Satan. I don't want you to think about the Satan as this evil, I don't know what to call it, an evil devil walking around and just trying to destroy. No, it is this work of God creating this ability to have a balance in the world. And therefore, the choices that we make are indeed choices. And the decision for decency is a decision and not just something that we were leveraged into, as the rabbis sometimes like to say, it was as if God lifted up the whole mountain and held it over our heads and gave us no choice whatsoever. But even if that was the case and you love that image, well, look at this, a couple of weeks later, they very much had a choice. And not only did they have a choice, there were some of them, 3,000, who acted upon this choice, who decided, no, this is a good idea. But where did this come from? So I'm going to say it again. The thing that we sometimes, and I'm going to be very serious. I really do believe that to a great extent, this is the challenge of our generation. It really is a challenge of mental health and a challenge to fight against depression. and to fight. I mean, we are so blessed in so many ways. And yes, I know that the historical blip of the last 2 years of a pandemic is something which leads us in directions of, look how our lives have turned into something which is so, so different. But think about the moment before the pandemic. Our lives were blessed in so many ways where I truly believe that the person who lived 500 years ago who would have looked at our lives today would have perceived this as being the Messianic Age, just in terms of how human beings have been liberated from drudgery of life. Next time you do laundry and it's really a pain separating darks and colors and putting it in the machine and pushing a button, just remember what more likely than not our great-grandmothers did in terms of trying to get clothing clean. And by the way, now think about the clothing they had in the first place. And if that's not enough for you, think about paper, think about toilet paper, okay? I'm just saying, our lives are blessed in more ways than we possibly realize, but nonetheless, the people, and some of them are the haves, not the have-nots, who nonetheless feel an emptiness, and they feel this depression, and they feel that there's something which is so terribly wrong. How does that happen? And now you go back to Mount Sinai, and you say, what in the world led them from one moment being at a people where God is speaking to them in a nation of priests, to the next moment they're standing there and they are dancing around a golden calf? So I think that the path that took them there included this feeling of depression and feeling of guilt and feeling that they killed Moshe and feeling like there's nothing is going to be of any meaning whatsoever at this point, and therefore the very things that God says are going to be the very things that we need to go against and we need to ignore. And all of that emerges at Mount Sinai until, of course, something else happens, and that is that Moshe comes back and Moshe comes down. And then we continue our story, and the rest of the story is interesting, but not as interesting. I mean, we like sin better. It's far more intriguing, and it's far more intriguing how even people at Mount Sinai are able to sin, but how they get there, as I said, you can choose the cover-ups if you like. We can blame the error of Rav then and now. We can say it was never intended, there was never their intention to replace Moshe with a golden calf. You can say they just wanted to appoint a judge, so why not Aaron? Why not Hur? But instead, something seems to go terribly, terribly wrong. And I think that's the missing point over here, is that they think Ha'ish Moshe, the man who took us out, in one breath, they elevated him. He's the one who took us out. And in the same breath, they brought him back down to earth. Moshe's the man. And he's gone. We don't know what happened to him, but maybe that's exactly the point. We don't want to think about what happened to him, because maybe Moshe's dead and he's not coming back. And if Moshe's dead and he's not coming back, maybe we're the ones responsible for that. And that's a kind of guilt that I don't know if people begin to imagine how they can possibly deal with.